This is Virginia speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 WLPR FM Lowell. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we're going to bring the voices that we've had on already about the issue of legislative redistricting reform. That's Lee Morris, who is, of course, from Northwest Indiana, as well as Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura and Susan Duncan, who's a member of the League of Women Voters Calumet area. And then a little later, we'll continue the conversation on redistricting reform with the latest about the issue from Julia Vaughn. She's mentioned in our earlier conversation. Julia is with Common Cause of Indiana. Originally speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. Lee Morris, a veteran Northwest Indiana government and community official, and Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura were in the studio recently, along with Susan Duncan from the League of Women Voters Calumet area, to talk about the grassroots campaign that encourages town and city councils across the state to get their legislators to support redistricting reform. So far, more than two dozen city and town councils in the region have signed on to a resolution that encourages the General Assembly to change its method of creating boundaries for legislative districts. Here's a conversation on Regionally Speaking, beginning first with Lee Morris's explanation of the issue and the statewide grassroots campaign.
Redistricting reform is to deal with something we call gerrymandering. A lot of people have heard of that term, but what it means is the manipulation of how legislative and congressional districts are drawn so that one party or the other may be favored. And this is not anything that's exclusive to either party. It happens. It's happened through the years. And it's been a particular problem here in Indiana. As a matter of fact, the University of Chicago did a study a few years ago that indicated Indiana's districting was the fifth most partisan redistricting they've seen in their analysis. So what we're advocating is going to a nonpartisan redistricting reform so that no political party is benefited. Very specific standards for how you delineate the districts and a structure that gets it done outside the political process. It still has to be approved by the elected officials, but the whole process is done outside of that political venue, which has resulted in the gerrymandering we have now. Okay. The resolution is simply a document that lays out why this is important and expresses support of a unit of government for the nonpartisan redistricting. And that's really important because although we've got a very well-structured proposal in Indiana, we've not been able to get a legislative hearing on it in the General Assembly. So we think it may be important for the legislators to hear from the people locally about how important this is and that it is something that really needs to have their attention and action.
And I suppose by the fact that all of these similar, if not the same resolution, has come up before these town and city councils here in Northwest Indiana, and these people have shown their support for this resolution, at least it gets the word out in their communities as to what this is all about.
Exactly, exactly.
Susan, how did the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area get involved in this?
Well, the League, as you know, is a voter advocacy organization, and I want to underscore what Lee just said about the analysis that indicates that Indiana is one of the worst gerrymandered, partisan gerrymandered states in the country. It also has one of the lowest voter turnouts in the country. Many experts and activists believe that the more partisan gerrymandered, the more gerrymandered districts you have, the more voters come to believe that their votes don't count for anything. And this suppresses voter turnout, and we all know what the bad consequences are of a suppressed voter turnout. So the League is in a coalition with Indiana Common Cause and about a dozen other organizations around the state to push for an independent commission to handle redistricting reform, and it's particularly important right now because the 2020 census is going to happen, and the year after that, the legislature will have to do a redistricting, and we want to have an independent commission in place before that date arrives.
I know you mentioned Indiana Common Cause, and I've seen some articles in the Indianapolis Star in recent months mentioned that the director of Indiana Common Cause, Julia Vaughn, has become sort of the face of redistricting reform. Although she's not the only face, there are a lot of other faces around Indiana, but I know she's the one that is the best known, it seems, yes. and certainly the most vocal of, I'm sure, many very vocal voices about this.
Indeed.
Mayor Stuhura, give us an example from your standpoint as the mayor of the city of Whiting, what Lee and other people who have brought this idea of redistricting reform in the form of this resolution have brought to you, that you in turn turned over to your city council, and why they have become the one of at least, now what, 24? 25 communities in Northwest Indiana who are members of the group that has supported redistricting reform.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is that the city council has always supported good public policy, and this is really, truly good public policy. And, you know, you have to make some changes in the system we have to make it work. Almost at the same time, both Lee and Susan approached Lee contacted me, and Susan, as a resident of Whiting, contacted her city councilman. And it didn't take them long to review it and understand that it's the right thing to do and certainly something that we could support. And they took pretty quick action on it. And I appreciate them for doing that. It's they're not afraid to step up to the plate, and that's what they did.
When this all came up for discussion before the council, what did some of the council members have to say about this?
Yeah, actually, you know, the discussion was actually pretty minimal. You know, I think when they all read it, they totally understood it. And, of course, it's got a national kind of tone to the discussion. Now you see things in Pennsylvania and other states now that where there's some action going on. So they're well aware of the issues and the problems. So it was very easy for them to put it on the floor and to take a vote.
Do you think, and I'll open up the question to any of our people here in the studio to answer, do you think that in light of the fact that Northwest Indiana has unfortunately historically been known as an organization, an area with organizations that have very distinct political subdivisions and viewpoints and opinions, do you think that maybe that this particular resolution is more successful this time around than, we'll say, 20, 30 years ago, back in the days when the quote-unquote political corruption seemed to reign in Northwest Indiana?
I think you may be right, Chris, but I think also people are aware that the low voter turnout in Indiana is a very serious problem and that it's a multifaceted problem. Getting the districting done properly so that we have a better representation for people is an important ingredient in that process. 43% of the positions in our Indiana General Assembly were uncontested the last time around. And that's a really a symptom, I think, of the fact that we don't have good voter engagement. And dealing with the redistricting is a very important issue in that regard. I've looked at the six states that have the highest turnout. You know, I look at Minnesota with 75% turnout. Indiana, in our primary election, we're probably going to have about 15-16%. Mm-hmm. Colorado has 72%. Wisconsin has 70%. So what I did, I looked at each one of those states and said, what have they done differently from Indiana that's enabling them to have that kind of turnout? And redistricting is one of them. Certainly, same-day voter registration is another we're going to be looking at. Vote by mail has been a major factor in a number of states where high turnouts are occurring. So Indiana doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. There are states out there that are doing a great job, and we simply need to learn from them, I believe. And that's what we're trying to help do with this.
Do you think that this, along with these other measures that you're proposing, and that many others are proposing as well, to try to boost voter turnout, this in turn will maybe make it easier to get more people interested in becoming political candidates and being involved in public office?
I think so. And, you know, I'm interested in what Susan and Joe's experience has been, but I've detected a renewed interest in engagement in the political process, particularly by young people. I think they're seeing that they don't really like what's been happening in the political process, and they know it's not going to change unless they get involved. Mm-hmm. And so that increased enthusiasm is really encouraging to me.
We mentioned just a few of the communities here in particular in Lake and County in particular that are involved in this redistricting reform with the resolution. There are other communities in Porter and LaPorte counties and surrounding counties as well. Just a few of these that are around Northwest Indiana. What's been the opinion of these folks that have decided to join the bandwagon, so
well,
to speak?
Well, we've had a lot of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I think people are recognizing that it is an important step to take, and it's probably not going to happen unless we demonstrate that support from the grassroots. I think our legislators are very sensitive when they hear input from cities and towns and counties about issues that are important, and I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to get the full consideration of this proposal in the next session of the General Assembly. We'll be able to get an actual hearing on it in the committees so that the houses in our General Assembly then have an opportunity to vote on it. And I believe there will be strong support for this. This is not a partisan issue at all, in my opinion. So,
do you think that because there are so many communities, not only locally, but also across Indiana, and we're talking about communities around the state that include like South Bend and Lafayette and West Lafayette and Vincennes and Anderson and Crawfordsville and Evansville, mm-hmm. as far south as Evansville, mm-hmm. that more communities in Indiana are much more interested in this, besides the ones that you would normally think of as being very politically active, like Bloomington, yes. and Muncie and places like that?
Indeed, I agree completely. We've got about 12 other cities and towns right now that are underway with consideration. Hobart was the most recent one here in this region. The town of Highland is having a study session on this tonight with their town council. But we've got about 10 others across mainly northern Indiana, because that's where I'm working right now, mm-hmm. That I hope will join this group so that we can go to the General Assembly with a high degree of support being expressed from back home.
When you say talking about being representing northern Indiana communities, how far to the east did you move out of Northwest Indiana to talk to
I'm over in Fort Wayne.
What are the folks in South Bend and Fort Wayne, what do they think about this?
South Bend is very supportive. Mm-hmm. Fort Wayne has not yet fully considered it, but we're working on it. I'm optimistic that mm-hmm. they will be, because it's a progressive city.
Now, Susan, when you had a chance with your standpoint with the League of Women Voters, you mentioned earlier about the fact that we've gotten organizations like Common Cause in Indiana involved in this and people like Julia Vaughn involved. What kind of information do you learn in contact with them as to how other communities and other places in the state are coming along in this campaign as well?
Well, Julia Vaughn is tremendously knowledgeable. She's got her finger on the pulse of all the different communities around Indiana. I would say there's guarded optimism about the chance for a resolution to be heard in the 2019 session. Guarded mm-hmm. because we still do have a Republican supermajority, mm-hmm. and it is in the interest of the Republican Party, despite this being a nonpartisan issue, there would be an interest on the part of the Republican Party to maintain districts as they are now, or tweak them even further to assure further Republican gains in the Assembly. So there is discussion among people like Julia Vaughn and the representative of District 1, Linda Lawson, that the real challenge here is convincing enough people in the state of both parties of the value of an independent redistricting commission to convince representatives who are in safe districts or uncontested districts that this is just the right thing to do for the electorate. Instituting redistricting reforms.
How do you think in Representative Lawson's case, since she's chosen not to run for re-election and she basically has served her last term of office in the General Assembly this past session, she is still very, very influential and very knowledgeable and has a lot of friends and a lot of influence outside of that. Do you think that now she'll be able to, if she hasn't already, going to spend more time helping push this through?
We have Linda Lawson scheduled to spend more of her time working on this issue already.
That's good. Yes. She's already committed to the time. That's good.
Right. Well, we're capitalizing on her expertise and her, get up and go.
And I know that she in the past has spoken very highly of this, but the importance of this to make sure that people are aware of this, that the problems that can come about politically as well as socially and economically from not having properly district to districts, as you
wish. I'd actually like to say something about that. The consequences are very widespread, much more so than most people who haven't given a lot of thought to this realize. The whole process is politically polarizing. If you have very partisan gerrymandered districts, what happens is that the really important elections become the primary elections, where the people in opposition are all speaking to the most extreme elements of the party base. And whoever comes out of that process in a safe district is likely then to become the representative of the district as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so we end up with a more partisan, more polarized political system. And pretty much everybody agrees that doesn't work out well for anyone.
Okay. Mayor Suhura, we're going to give you the last word in the conversation for now here. And following along here, what impact do you see economically in your community of Whiting that this, in turn, the redistricting reform can benefit the citizens as well as the government office holders?
Yeah, that's a tough question, but I mean, I just think, you know, when you enact good public policy and you can then change some of the negative aspects of the current system, that it benefits everybody throughout the region. I mean, you know, you could take a look at some of the maps, right? The gerrymandered maps, they're actually look like cartoons,
right?
They're spread across so many different districts. And like Susan says, it's not only it's discouraging to people to understand that the process it works in that way, you know. So when it's all said and done, you know, it's sticking to what's right is always works, and you know, you're always going to have a party in power at one point or another, but soon down the road, the other party will also be in power. You know, things will flip. So doing the right thing in a nonpartisan way always benefits the greater community.
That is Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura. And a legal update on redistricting reform is coming up with our conversation ahead with Julia Vaughn at 12:30. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's the host of Green Fleet Radio, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Elias Grimm, a board member for the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Elias, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So tell our listeners, what is the Food Council and why does our region need one?
Yeah. The Food Council is a relatively new nonprofit group serving seven counties.
Okay.
So we're not only Lake Porter, LaPorte, but also, I hope I can remember these, Jasper, Newton, Pulaski, and Stark.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty big region. We came into existence because there was a group of people that felt, you know, we have a local food system that is very disconnected.
Okay.
Now, I'm not obviously talking about big ag. You could say I'm talking about local food in the sense of smaller farmers.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about grocery stores, food banks, food access programs, food processors, food retailers. All of that is scattered pretty far and wide, which makes it very inefficient. And it's probably part of the reason that agriculture in general is 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions.
I see. And so is the Northwest Indiana Food Council part of a local government or some other organization?
Often food councils are, mm-hmm. or part of a university. We are not.
Okay.
We're a standalone. So we have come together after an initial meeting a couple of years ago at Valparaiso University, and our first programs have been, first of all, a thing called the FED event, the FED Summit. FED stands for Food Expo.
Okay.
And we had a one-day event over at County Line Orchard, and we talked about food access, food justice, and all sorts of related food issues for a full day. This kind of stuff includes farm to school,
okay.
which is a very interesting kind of movement going on nationwide. It's now in something like 46 states. And then a second event that we did last year, we're about to have another couple of them, is called a farm hop. Surprisingly, in the state of Indiana, there are quite a few people who have never actually met a farmer. Or been to a farm, or even been to a farm. This is very possible because, you know, when I was a little kid, I think there were 24 million farmers in America.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there are 2 million.
Wow.
So, and the smaller farms are beginning to gradually come back. Middle-sized farms have almost gone away.
I see. So do you get involved in politics, or is this somewhat your group, something that your group somewhat steers away from?
We don't do politics because we're a 501c3. We can't really endorse anybody. Mm-hmm. We are interested in advocacy for certain kinds of food policies.
I see.
For example, to make it easier to become a young farmer in our state. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is not a simple thing anymore. So that would be an example.
You're listening to Green Fleet Radio, Elias Krim, board member for the Northwest Indiana Food Council. So I know people really like your programs, Elias. So why do you think they're so appealing?
Well, in a way, people want to connect to the local food economy. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to the grocery store and you see the options there. You look at a box of lettuce that maybe contains 80 calories of food energy.
Okay.
But if it came from California, it had to be grown, chilled, washed, packages, transported, maybe altogether to get in here, 4,600 calories of fossil fuel energy. That's a 57-to-1 ratio. When there's a guy just a few miles outside of town here that, if you'd known about him, could have sold you a delicious fresh box of lettuce.
Absolutely.
In a whole different way.
Absolutely. And so I know the average piece of food on our tables here in the region travels 1,500 miles to get here, or about the distance between Chicago and Las Vegas. So why does buying local help our economy, local farmers, and the environment?
You know, it's a great thing. It's the multiplier effect. And this is a fairly well-known idea, that buying from local businesses, that dollar gets passed around, gets circulated more widely than if you buy from a big chain retailer. So there are a lot of pieces to this food chain. There is the farmer, of course, but there's another piece of it that we're working on, which is the processor.
Okay.
And those businesses are kind of tricky. They require some education. They require being located logistically in the right place to kind of make the food chain efficient. But we certainly are interested in supporting the kind of middleman process so that, for example, our school systems can look at purchasing more locally, our hospitals, our universities. I just read that Valparaiso University is now buying 25% of its food locally.
Wonderful.
So that's the way they want to go.
No, it's exciting. So how can new people find out more about the Northwest Indiana Food Council and get involved with this terrific endeavor?
Yeah. As I say, we're a nonprofit, Carl. If you go to nwifoodcouncil.org, you'll see our programs, what we do. We're very interested in volunteers. We're interested in people who might want to sponsor our programs in some way. And what we're basically aimed at, I would say, is getting connected with local farmers. We want to get connected with our local school systems and other sort of institutional cafeterias. And we're also interested in community food programs and local gardens, such as in the city of Gary, which has now, I think, over 30 community gardens going.
Wonderful.
So a big movement behind that.
No, just exciting information, and we're hoping to have you on future shows, Elias.
Super. Great.
And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Elias, and board member for the Northwest Indiana Food Council. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Have a green week, and thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and later today as well, too. And the podcast, by the way, can also be found on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. The Indiana Coalition for Independent Redistricting is a coalition of organizations all across the state that are trying to get state lawmakers to reform the redistricting process. We've had this in a conversation locally, of course, before with Lee Morris and Susan Duncan with the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area, and with Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura recently about it. And they referred to this person who's our next guest, talking about the efforts statewide to get the redistricting reform underway. And we have an update here because the U.S. Supreme Court has offered us the update from another state. Julia Vaughn is the policy director with the Common Cause of Indiana, which is a co-founder of the ICIR, as we're calling it here. Julia, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. It's my pleasure.
The interest we've asked you to come on and talk about is a recent decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which is related, as we said, to Indiana's redistricting issue, or actually the bigger issue overall, which Lee Morris went right into and directly talked about the gerrymandering problem that Indiana lawmakers have seem to have to take up. That has a direct impact on not only legislative districts in Indiana, but the elections as well, too. They're all tied together. Tell us a little bit here, if you will, Julia, about how the U.S. Supreme Court seems to have stepped into the matter now.
Well, they really issued on Monday a non-decision, is what it's kind of amounting to, in a couple of partisan gerrymandering cases out of Wisconsin and Maryland. Now, in Wisconsin, it was the Republicans who have gerrymandered their state house and their congressional delegations, and in Maryland, it's the opposite. The Democrats controlled the process. So they're the gerrymanderers, and that's really something to keep in mind. Both parties, when they have the opportunity, they will take advantage of the ability to draw political maps to enhance the ability of their party's reelection efforts. So the main concern about this is it really takes voters out of the picture in too many districts in our state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, voters are supposed to be the folks in charge of elections, right? If we're not happy with the way our representative or our congressperson is representing us, then we have the opportunity to vote them out of office. But in too many districts across our state, both at the congressional and state legislative level, that isn't the case because the districts have been drawn and manipulated to benefit the party that was in power to draw them. And in 2011, it just so happened that here in Indiana, the Republican Party was in charge of both the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate, so that meant that they completely controlled the redistricting process. So since 2011, I think you can see the evidence, Republicans have been able to elect and maintain supermajorities in both the Indiana House, the Indiana Senate, and in our congressional delegation. Now, you know, some folks will push back and say, well, Indiana's a red state. They should be in the majority. Well, I believe that's true. I've been around Indiana politics all my life, and I do believe we are a slightly Republican state, but not to the tune of 70 and 80%. And that is the partisan divide that we currently have here in Indiana, with our congressional delegation and our state legislative delegations. You know, most statewide candidates in Indiana, Republicans typically would win with 56, maybe 57% of the vote, but not 70 to 80% of the vote. So I think there's clear evidence when you just look at election results that gerrymandering in 2011 has helped Republicans in Indiana keep and control their supermajorities in our Congress and in our state legislative delegation. Now, you know, what's the impact of that? Well, the legislative agenda. You know, I think the gridlock that we see in Congress on issues like immigration, you know, Republicans sort of have a litmus test now on those types of issues. And so, you know, if you're seen as weak on immigration, you won't be reelected during the Republican primary. There are issues at the state legislative level. You remember three or four sessions ago, the Indiana General Assembly passed the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, which embarrassed our state, caused a lot of people to look at the General Assembly and say, well, I wouldn't support something like that. Why are these people supporting these conservative policies that me and my neighbors don't really think are important? So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why more and more Hoosiers are recognizing this gerrymandering problem in Indiana, because it's having an impact on the policies that both our Congress and our state legislature are passing or not passing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, at least from what you've seen, and even in the most recent incidents here, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court not making a decision on some cases from other states, the fact that maybe that they're sitting back and doing a little more thorough review of all of this is
they're looking,
good?
Yeah, they are looking for the right case. You know, the court has recognized for a long time that partisan gerrymandering exists, but they've said traditionally that this is a political problem, not a legal problem. Well, the issue has evolved now, though, that more and more judges are recognizing that this is a legal problem because you're having voters having their votes or their power as voters being diluted, and so that it really is a legal issue. So, unfortunately, we were hoping that the decision that the Supreme Court handed down on Monday, we were really looking for a silver bullet to finally slay this gerrymander, and we didn't get that.
Uh-huh.
What we did get was sort of a non-decision. The Supreme Court kicked the Wisconsin case back to Wisconsin, the federal court there. They said, you need to refine your argument a little bit. Our side was arguing that Democrats as an organization in Wisconsin were being discriminated against. The court basically said, you know, we'd be more interested in your argument if you were focusing on the rights of individuals. So that's certainly helpful. You know, it's really nice to have the highest court in the land give you some pointers on how you can improve your argument. So the attorneys for our side are going back. They also told us that you'd have a more compelling argument if you focused on every district in the state and could prove that there's been harm. So they're going to go out and find a whole lot more litigants. That case is still brewing. The case out of Maryland that the Supreme Court on Monday also punted on, that one will be going back to a federal court in Maryland. And then there's a third partisan gerrymandering case that the Supreme Court did not take up this term, but they will take up later this year when they come back. And that's a case out of North Carolina. And, you know, the interesting thing is that all of these cases are slightly different. You know, the legal arguments are slightly different. The facts of the case, the election numbers are slightly different. And so, frankly, the redistricting reform community at this point is throwing a whole lot of stuff up against the wall, and we're seeing what sticks. And we do think that at some point one of these cases is going to stick, and we are going to have a court hand down a decision that says, yes, partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional because it is harming individuals. And here is this objective measure. Here is how we can look at these maps and tell when they have been gerrymandered to the point that voters don't matter anymore. You know, there are algorithms out there. There are computer programs that can be used. There's a whole lot of good science that is now being utilized in this fight. And one of these days, we are going to find the right combination to go into court and show judges exactly the harm that is being caused by this political practice. Once we get that overarching and strong decision coming down from the Supreme Court, then it will put legislatures across this country on notice that, you know, the judicial community is on to you. You're not going to be able to get away with this anymore. And if you draw maps that are partisan gerrymanders that take away power from the voters, they will be struck down. So we've got to have that tool, I think. You know, the problem with just trying to go into the legislature and convince the folks who benefit the most from gerrymandering to change it is that politicians don't operate against their self-interest very often.
Yeah.
You know, for most elected officials, really the most important question is, how do I get reelected? And, you know, if you can improve your chances every decade by the stroke of a pen, then you're fine with doing that. So we're asking our sitting legislators, this Republican supermajority that has been helped into their position by gerrymandering, we're asking them to take that tool away, to do away with it. So, it's a really difficult issue to work on. But that's why we're doing things like the Whiting resolution, the resolution that was most recently passed in Highland, Indiana. Those are important ways that elected officials from the local government level can say to our state legislature, hey, this gerrymandering, it's not just hurting individual voters, it's hurting communities across the state. I mean, I remember reading the news story from Hobart. Hobart is the third community in Lake County to pass our redistricting reform resolution. And one of the council members said, well, it's obvious that Lake County is gerrymandered because we have three state representative districts in Hobart. Yeah, that's ridiculous that a town the size of Hobart would be divided into three state rep districts. A state representative district has 66,000 people in it. So obviously Hobart would easily fit into one legislative district. I think it was sliced and diced because of partisan advantage. There can't be any other reason for that. So we're just really excited that folks like the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area, Lee Morris, the former mayor of LaPorte, Mayor Joe of Whiting, you know, these are important community leaders who are standing up and saying, this gerrymandering, it's hurting our citizens, it's hurting our community. We need to have an alternative. We need to take this job away from the state legislature. It's a huge conflict of interest. And instead, give this job to a diverse group of citizens that is representative of Hoosiers that will draw these districts for public interest reasons, not partisan political interests.
Julia, I also know, too, that that this seems, of course, what's happened here in Lake County, maybe not necessarily to other folks in Indiana, but they only have to go as far as their local legislative districts to see how they are affected by this as well. It's not just Lake County. It's every county in the state. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the other big problem that comes with gerrymandering is that we don't have enough competition in Indiana elections. You know, it will be about half of state legislative districts when in November there's only one name on the ballot because the district has been drawn to so heavily advantage a Republican or a Democrat. Now, there are Democratic districts that have been drawn to be overwhelmingly Democrat, and that's called packing. You know, when you pack a whole bunch of people of the same political party into one district, then those votes are wasted. You know, if you spread them out among a number of districts, then, you know, perhaps the Democrats would have a better chance of winning. So, yes, through packing, through cracking, which is obviously the opposite of packing,
right.
Instead of packing all the minority party into one district, you divide them up so that they're not really relevant. There aren't enough of them in any individual district. So, you know, this practice has been going on for literally hundreds of years here in Indiana. But the thing that I think has really set it over the top is the use of computers and sophisticated software that can put all sorts of demographic data and election data on top of the GIS software. So literally, you know, if a couple is the wife's a Republican and the husband's a Democrat, it seems that sometimes they'll draw the line down the middle of their bed. You know, it's sort of gerrymandering on steroids. The use of technology has really, really made this a dangerous thing. And you know, a lot of times people think that, oh, a gerrymander has to look funny. It's got to be a district that's all irregularly shaped and, you know, kind of crazy, not a regular square. Well, not necessarily. And again, I think the software and all of the data that they're able to use and really drive this process, you can draw really nice squares and still have gerrymandering. And, you know, that's one of the things that Republicans will point to. Well, look, our maps, they look pretty regular. You know, show me a crazy-looking district. Well, we've got them, but that is no evidence of the shape of a district is not necessarily an indication that it's been gerrymandered.
So
better to look at the election results.
So it looks like that the U.S. Supreme Court non-decisions, I guess, in this case, because of these other cases in other states, certainly hasn't hurt what the Indiana Coalition of Independent Redistricting is doing. It would have been better if it had happened sooner, but you're just biding your time, I suppose, and still following through with the intent.
Yeah, the big problem here is the clock is ticking. Yeah. You know, the next round of redistricting will happen in Indiana and elsewhere in 2021. It always happens in the year after the federal census, and that, of course, will happen in 2020. So in order to get the kind of reform which we want, and, you know, it's really two questions that you ask when you talk about reforming redistricting. The first one is who is going to be in charge of drawing the maps? And then the second one is how. How are they directed to draw the maps? The who part of the question is definitely the harder one to get the legislature to talk about. Right now, a majority of our legislators aren't supportive of the idea of taking this job away from the General Assembly, giving it to a representative group of citizens. But we're building support on that every day. We were able to get a bill through the Indiana Senate earlier this year that would have worked on the how part of the question. It would have still given the job of redistricting to the state legislature, but it would have put a set of public interest criteria into the law that they would have to follow. For example, it would have told them to keep cities and towns in one district whenever possible. Mm-hmm. So Hobart wouldn't be divided into three different state rep districts. It would only have one. Now, there was some language that if for some reason that wasn't a good idea, you could deviate from that, but you would have to state that in the law. You know, we divided Hobart up this way because there was some good public policy reason to do so. So, again, trying to introduce into the redistricting process some rules that would encompass public interest policies rather than just the interest of partisan politicians. So that bill, again, it was a halfway measure. It certainly wasn't everything we wanted and needed, but we got that bill through the Indiana Senate. It was really pretty historic, the first time any redistricting bill has even been heard in the Indiana Senate. So it was a great thing that we were able to get it passed. It was a strong bipartisan vote, 43-6. So we had some momentum coming out of the Senate. We got over to the House, and lo and behold, just like last year, the chair of the House Elections Committee killed our bill by refusing to give it a hearing. Good news is he won't be back next year. He's calling it a career and not running for re-election, so we'll have a new House Elections Committee chair. Hopefully somebody who is more interested in the topic of redistricting reform than the chairman we're losing.
Well, it sounds like at least it's another issue to look forward to coming up in the 2019 General Assembly session after the elections this November, and making some changes, no doubt, in how the makeup of the General Assembly is going to happen then anyway. So another thing to keep an eye on for the months ahead, beyond just the local elections, to be sure. Julia Vaughn is the Policy Director for Common Cause Indiana, which is a co-founder of the Indiana Coalition for Independent Redistricting, which we have referred to before talking about redistricting reform. And Julia, thank you for spending time with us, a very complete explanation of this. And we know that maybe the U.S. Supreme Court didn't quite happen to put out some decisions to look forward to now. But we, as we say, bide our time and wait to see what happens. And 2019 is going to be another good year to take a look at what may happen with the makeup of the General Assembly. Thank you for spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Well, thanks so much, Chris, and thanks to all the activists in Lake County who are doing so much to help this effort. We really appreciate it.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions in our newest segment, Ask Ollie. And the pet questions are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his woman-human, Victoria Voller. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, fireworks can be deadly for a dog because they can't and don't experience them like they experience a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm comes into an area with a lot of warning signs, like changes in barometric pressure and high winds, so dogs can anticipate and prepare for them. Mary Ann Massa, a retired fourth-grade Gary Community School Corporation teacher, came home from a cruise last July to find her beloved dog, Sadie, dead from a heart attack. Her veterinarian, Dr. Dale Quivey from Broadway Pet Hospital in Merrillville, told Mary Ann he thought the attack was brought on by the stress from the sounds of area firework explosions. Mary Ann adopted Sadie, a Belgian-German Shepherd from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. She was a shelter dog that had belonged to an ex-Marine who named her simply Jarhead. This dog was trained to attack and guard 24 hours a day. No one knew if she was ever on the front lines. That behavior, Mary Ann remembered, couldn't be changed. She had been assigned to a Navy SEAL division and her future didn't look bright, so I adopted her after my previous dog had died of cancer. Mary Ann recalls the 5 years she had with Sadie. She was loyal and devoted and followed me everywhere, even leaving her dinner dish to be where I was. When Mary Ann left for her cruise last July, she soundproofed the house and hired a very responsible dog sitter. After the fireworks began, and they started way before the 4th of July, the sitter came over to check on Sadie, and the dog was in a corner just shaking. The next day, when the sitter checked, Sadie was lying on the floor, and her breath was labored. By the time Mary Ann returned home, Sadie had died. "Her death broke my heart," recalled Mary Ann. "When I came home to my empty house, I comforted myself by sleeping for many nights afterwards in the same spot on the living room floor where Sadie had died." There are many dogs that are scared by thunderstorms, and I'm one of them. My name is Raisin, and I'm a big mixed-breed rescue dog, and my owners, Union Township residents Randy and Anna McCasland, actually do professional community firework shows. My pet mother knows that I'm scared of fireworks. She protects me from the noise by setting me up in the master bedroom, soundproofing it, running the air conditioner, and turning on the television to a noisy channel. That strategy works for me. My heart rate remains normal, and I don't have that goofy rush of adrenaline or stress or hormones circulating through my body. I'm telling you these stories, Ollie, because I know that many dogs are not freaked out by the sound of fireworks. But for me, a summer of fireworks can be horrific, and for Sadie, a death sentence. Regards, Raisin. Victoria, that's a story that we hear all too often about, not only for animals, but for soldiers who are returning from war, suffering from PTSD. Fireworks are something that causes a lot of issues for a lot of pets and a lot of people across Northwest Indiana. One thing I think that's really important to know as well, when it comes to fireworks laws, especially on the 4th of July, anyone under the age of 18 can only possess and use fireworks in the presence of an adult. The other dates throughout the course of the year include Memorial Day and New Year's Eve, along with Labor Day. Fireworks can only be discharged from 9 a.m. to 12 a.m. Fireworks retailers must have a permit from the Indiana State Fire Marshal to sell consumer fireworks, whereas right over the state line in Illinois, Illinois bans the sale, possession, and use of all consumer fireworks, which includes the stuff you can buy legally in some states, like firecrackers, bottle rockets, and Roman candles, which is so often why we see the Illinois State Police and the troopers on the other side of the state line throughout the month of June and into July, looking for people who have just gone over the border here in Indiana to buy fireworks. Those fireworks businesses, a lot of money, millions of dollars in a matter of days, maybe a week. And more often than not, we're not really thinking about the pets or our neighbors. And that's something I think we probably need to do.
I would agree with you. The fireworks starts extremely early. You're saying Memorial Day. I'm thinking they'll start shooting them off in May. And for a dog, this goes on from May until possibly September. That's the entire month of, you know, summer months. And then they start up again, like you said, New Year's Eve, because it's legal. But there is big money in fireworks. I mean, I used to see a store that would sell fireworks for a week and then close down for the rest of the year. And they made enough money in a week to support paying the rent for a whole year. Dear Raisin, thank you for sharing your stories. I know it was difficult for you. I read your letter, and I gotta say, this is a real coincidence. Because I know Mary Ann Massa, too. Mary Ann has been on the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana Board of Directors for years and is always organizing and volunteering at their adopt-a-thons. Her service to animals and for animals is phenomenal. And many, many dogs and cats have found forever homes due to her generosity of time and resources and her tireless devotion to their rescue. You know, I was adopted from there 12 years ago, and I was their very first dog ever that could read and write. Imagine that. But I digress. So back to the fireworks thing. I'm not afraid of fireworks, but my West Highland Terrier pet sister, Molly May, is very much afraid. Her veterinarian, Dr. Carol Darts from Arborview Pet Clinic in Valparaiso, prescribes for her an anti-anxiety drug, and that seems to work. I have heard of other people using thunder shirts or trying to desensitize their dogs to those kinds of noises before they begin. Anyway, Raisin, be careful on the 4th of July. I wish for you that my favorite film, The Secret Lives of Pets, is broadcast for your enjoyment while you relax in the master bedroom during freaky fireworks time. And I do have some good news for you. This past April, your friend Mary Ann adopted yet another dog from the shelter and named him Tanner. Tanner is a lucky dog. Your friend in fur, Ollie. And you know what I say, love is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Attention vacationers and others headed south to Indianapolis. A 35-day shutdown of a section of Indianapolis's I-65 downtown is going to start Sunday. I-65 will be closed from Meridian Street to just north of Methodist Hospital, and southbound lanes at I-465 on Indianapolis's northwest side will also be closed. In that, Commissioner Joe McGinnis acknowledges it's going to make driving a pain, but he says keeping one lane open would be worse.
If we pinch it down to two lanes, you could be in excess of 3 to 4 months of construction, which is extremely painful if you're only down to one or two lanes. If we can do a full closure, you're looking at probably a week to a week and a half and half the cost. It's like ripping the Band-Aid off, and it's a lot safer.
By closing it completely, he says it would be done in just a few weeks at half the cost. McGinnis says that closing the road to speed up the work means that the highway would then be ready to open by the time that school starts in the fall. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll talk with Carrie Napoleon of the Post Tribune, and Dan McGowan with Inside Indiana Business with the Business News, and Kelly Smith will be with us for the first time from the Michigan City News Dispatch.